Hey folks, welcome to another episode of Long Shots. Hey Sharath, how's it going, man?
It's going well, and as usual, I'm excited again, but I'm more excited because we're entering into newer verticals for our conversations.
Yes, a vertical about which I don't think we can claim any kind of real or pseudo expertise.
Yeah.
We have with us Mr. Chet Kondragunta, CEO of Aira Metrics. Chet, it's a pleasure to have you. How are you?
Pleasure being here. Thank you all. Hope everything is good with both of you as well.
Yeah, no, all well. Hope the same at your end. No, thanks. Thank you so much for finding the time. I'll give a bit of a, you know, intro from my end. Obviously, you run Aira Metrics, a company which provides AI-powered solutions within the realms of life sciences and healthcare. Previously, you founded and also listed a company which went by the way name of Analytics Insight in Toronto, big data analytics firm. You were also CEO of Stern Stewart, a corporate finance and strategy consulting firm. So I'm very excited because obviously you have kind of worked both on the realms of, you know, technology, automation, as well as on the kind of vantage point of corporate finance. So it's a pleasure to have you with us.
My pleasure as well.
So, Chet, the best way to start this conversation would be to understand a bit more about Aira Metrics, in terms of, obviously, artificial intelligence is the buzzword. You know, we've been hearing about it for now close to, I would say, half a decade. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of operators on the street who claim to do AI, very few actually end up doing it. So there's a lot of, mystery around AI as a concept. We'll get into that, but before that, would be, be great to get a bit of context about Aira Metrics and its main value proposition.
Sure. Aira Metrics is based out of Mumbai. We are about a 70-person company, and we focus pretty much on providing AI solutions for the life sciences space. And in the life sciences space, well, it's a slightly broad space. What we focus on is on the pharmaceutical drug and discovery side, and on the clinical diagnostic side of things as well. So that's, and our forte is actually in image analysis. Mm-hmm. And providing AI-based solutions for image analysis. The images we happen to analyze are actually either biopsy images, if you're looking at it from a clinical diagnostic space, pathology images that come in slides that are then digitized, and then we provide solutions to analyze that. Or if you're looking at the pharmaceutical drug and drug discovery space, we look at typically tissue samples from animal studies for new drug candidates, which are being tested out towards the path of actually being a viable drug that finally ends up in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So that's our broad focus. We've been around for the better part of about 8 years now.
Right.
We started off in the pharmaceutical space, where we focused on this drug discovery and development side of things. How do we speed up the drug discovery and development process, and how can we help in that? Mm-hmm. So one of the key questions there is when a new molecule is quote-unquote discovered, even before you get into looking fully at the efficacy of that molecule for whatever problem it's supposed to solve, let's say for asthma or for cancer, whatever it is, before the efficacy is fully resolved, one of the first things a pharma company needs to do is understand, is the molecule even safe? Does it have any toxic effects? It could very well work for asthma and for the lungs, but it might be causing issues elsewhere in the body. And so that's one of the first things, physician do no harm kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. So that it comes from that perspective. And so companies spend a lot of time on the toxicology safety testing side of things. And one of the obvious features that comes out of that is several hundred animals are used in that process,
right.
Where they're obviously injected with the drug candidate and then, sacrificed to understand, the effect on various tissues and that sort of thing. So there's a fair amount of trial and error that goes into that process. Mm-hmm. That is where we first started by looking to see, could we provide some kind of an automated solution.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In the first place that would help speed up that process, at least in that sense, provide the impetus for drugs to come that much faster into the marketplace. is. Mm-hmm. We have since expanded that, you know, to see if could we even do some predictive side of things there, which then minimizes the use of animals. So, you know, if you're looking at a 30-day animal study, and then, you know, companies typically do a 14-day, 30-day, 6-month, you know, 2-year, et cetera, kind of studies on in terms of understanding the toxicity. We are trying to figure out if we can do a very small period of study and can we then predict the rest of it, mm-hmm. you know, right. using modeling techniques, which obviously is, you know, got several benefits. It obviously saves costs for the company, but it also saves you know, the need in terms of having repeated animal testing and those kind of things. So there are obviously some societal benefits and ethical benefits as well mm-hmm. that come out of that. But that was our flagship product, and that's where it started. But over the last 3-4 years, we've taken that sort of expertise in looking at tissue samples. You know, we are looking at liver, kidney, heart, etc. from animal side of things first. But then we've expanded that to now getting them do things on the human clinical diagnostic side of things. Mm-hmm. There we focus largely in the couple of things on the oncology space, where we look at prostate cancer, we look at lung cancer. Those are our two big ones. We do a couple of minor things as well. Mm-hmm. And then, interestingly, we're also in the ophthalmology space, where mm-hmm. we look at retinal images. One is obviously to diagnose, you know, diseases that might be causing blindness. And in a country like India, what's important is, you know, you should be able to do this soon. And right now, there are several solutions, but they're all unitaskers, in a mm-hmm. sense that they work on something that looks at diabetic retinopathy or something that looks at macular degeneration, et cetera, et cetera. We have decided that, you know, the best solution for a country like India is, could we find one algorithm that, you know, provides instant answers at least to 25, 30 odd eye diseases, right, and right. can we put that on a cheap mm-hmm. eye in a camera kind of thing that could perhaps even be mounted on a cell phone or something like that. Mm-hmm. So then you can take that out into the villages and, you know, the interiors of India and be able to do a lot more primary diagnostic in one shot. As well, so simplifying that. The second aspect of that is there are several diseases today which require a lot of invasive techniques, you know, things like, especially the neurodegenerative ones, things related to the brain, like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, etc. But obviously, you cannot have any kind of biopsy or that sort of thing to determine if there's a disease or not, because that's simply not done given it's the brain, you know, and you can't really bore into the skull, you know, just for a biopsy kind of thing. So the good news there is the retina, you know, with all of the blood vessels that are evident there, is a pretty good window into, you know, other conditions that might be happening in the body. And so our thesis is we should be able to find patterns in looking at retinal images to identify neurodegenerative diseases mm-hmm. as well, which is again important, especially for a country like India, which now has a certain amount of aging population. You know, and given the size of a country, in any case, you know, even if the elderly population is a smaller percentage compared to other countries, in absolute numbers, it's a pretty big number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then these are the kind of things that are now coming up. So these are the areas that we focus on. And that's pretty much Aera Matrix's mission, is to find meaningful solutions to some of these problems, either in the pharmaceutical industry or on the clinical side of it.
You know, you started talking about, you know, trials in vaccine development or drug development, and sort of yeah. even talked about diagnostics. And is sort of from an Indian context, like, is there enough digitization already there to even, you know, extract that many data points to come up with predictive solutions? Like, how far ahead in the digitization curve are we right now? Because that sort of becomes the backbone for any AI play, correct?
Sure. It's a. I'll interpret that as a slightly broader question. Mm-hmm. In a sense, you know, when we talk about digitization in sort of the healthcare side of things, there's obviously the whole patient record side of things and mm-hmm. hospital records and all of those kind of things, and that by itself is a massive challenge mm-hmm. for any country or any hospital system. So there's that. Then you know, if we sort of walk back from that sort of value chain, if you will, you know, before we get into the hospital side of things, then obviously the whole, you know, clinical trials and the efficacy of drugs, you know, and the diagnostic part of it and all of those kind of things that come in. Either the doctor being able to diagnose something using digital tools mm-hmm. or even, you know, what kind of drug is finally coming to them and are there any digital techniques being used there, right? So that's how sort of looking at the pharma space, then the clinical diagnostic space, and finally the patient management space as well. So all three of which have their own set of unique challenges in terms of digitization. Mm-hmm. And so in that context, if you look at where India is, and we're seeing it today as well, you know, in terms of kind of situation we're all living in, we've had a track record of very little investment in healthcare infrastructure, mm-hmm. right, over several decades.
Right.
So that obviously has manifested itself in shortcomings even in the digital space. I mean, we're a large country and we have our own unique challenges, and there are some challenges certainly on the primary side of things. Right. Forget digitization and all of those kind of things. So, but from a trickle-down effect, obviously, digitization is also in that sense. The attention given to it is less mm-hmm. compared to other countries, but that's where we are.
Yeah.
We ourselves find that challenge as well. So we're sort of in a unique position where we are wholly located in India. All of our employees and everything that we do, our servers, etc., whatever else, even the entire infrastructure that we have is in India. But all of our clients are outside India.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which sort of speaks to the question you asked, mm-hmm. because obviously, at the end of the day, our solutions run on some kind of a digital infrastructure, right? Whether it's from the data side or from the computing side, whatever it is. And I guess one answer, one way to sort of answer your question is the fact that our solutions are largely today applicable outside India is because the recipients there have invested.
Right.
That sort of digital infrastructure.
Interesting.
We're finding that. Having said that, certainly in the last couple of years, we are seeing sort of more and more interest from Indian hospitals, pharma companies, certainly the teaching hospitals for sure.
Mm-hmm.
They've been encouraged to go the digital route, and so they're all looking to invest in digital infrastructure and simultaneously look for digital solutions, because obviously both of them go hand in hand.
Yeah.
You can't simply just have infrastructure and then what do you do with it?
We're
seeing that.
When you were talking about IRMatrix focus areas, you did obviously mention diagnostics, areas like oncology, and there's obviously, there's a lot of, I guess, overlap in terms of visual diagnostic domains, right? We keep on obviously hearing about different deep learning, machine learning systems who now are able to detect cancers better than or more accurately than human eyes. So I'm guessing a lot of pattern recognition work goes behind the scenes, right? I mean, a lot of these algorithms are built probably on the logic that you put in a lot of historical data on particular scenarios and situations, tag them, identify them, and form a pattern which kind of, over time will go towards the predictive side of things. And that's very different from how, like, if you look at artificial intelligence, that probably is the way it gets built up, right? I mean, it's pretty much data-driven, brute-force-driven. And it's quite different from the way human intelligence works. In case of human intelligence, I think it's also very difficult to even explain or articulate on how human intelligence works, but definitely not in the same way. Is long term, do you see some sort of a hybrid marriage between both of these philosophies when it comes to more automation? Or you think the way AI has kind of gone by, that's just a better approach, that's just a more quote-unquote efficient approach of, doing diagnostics? I mean, I'm kind of trying to put a more philosophical, question out.
That's fair. This sort of relates a little bit to the last question as well, in terms of the amount of data that's, required for any reasonable AI-based algorithm to work. Because end of the day, especially when we look at in the area of AI, when we look at deep learning and that sort of thing, there is, I suppose for want of a better word, a certain brute force mentality to it where you need lots of data to be fed in you know, for the algorithms to mature or to be robust, to be able to handle, you know, more of the corner cases. And that's something that's especially true in the area of medicine and human diagnostics, because the price for failure in those are quite significant, you know, in terms of how it affects a certain individual's life. If you, you know, if your algorithm is not robust enough, or it's not picked up those sort of corner cases, you know, and in some way, medicine is all about corner cases, right? Because no two patients are alike, and you know, all those kind of things. And in some way, that's where a well-trained doctor is quite superior, right? That cognitive ability or the ability to, and probably philosophically speaking, you know, if you're not talking about the differences between human intelligence and artificial intelligence in a way, you know, the biggest thing about human intelligence is its extreme adaptability and the ease with which it, you know, humans can adapt to new situations, you know, or new stimuli that are coming to us, right? I mean, and being able to respond, you know, in a coherent, rational manner, and that's what leads to progress and, you know, rational thinking and the reaction that comes from human intelligence, which is what a trained physician, you know, would do. You know, that is an obvious shortcoming for an artificial intelligence system, because it is end of the day going to be very good in providing response, accuracy, objectivity, consistency, but across end of the day, quote unquote, a finite set of or a finite universe of cases or conditions that it has seen.
Right.
So, but within that sphere, you know, would it do quite well in terms of you know, matching or beating, let's say, the accuracy or the consistency or the limiting bias, you know, compared to human observers? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But you know, now it. I mean, my sort of anecdote on this, in you know, obviously AI systems have been around for a while. You know, an AI system has beaten Garry Kasparov at chess, mm-hmm. right, a long time back. So great, you know, but you know, now if you ask both of those two sort of chess participants to make you a cup of coffee, I'm sure Garry Kasparov can give you a passable cup of coffee. I mean, I've never met him, and I don't know what his capabilities are, but I'm sure he can give you a passable cup of coffee.
Right, right.
The system that beat Garry Kasparov cannot give you a cup of coffee.
Right. Right?
So there has to be a whole other set of retraining and retraining and that kind of thing to do, even though it's quote unquote intelligent enough to beat the best in the world at a particular task.
I guess that's like
the second task, you know. And sure, once that system is trained to do very well, then it can, of course, give you a great cup of coffee, you know, without any variation, etc., you know, X months from now, once it's developed and done. But today, Garry Kasparov can do both of those things.
So I guess there's like a bridge between like what you call AI or artificial intelligence and general intelligence, right? In terms of more broad-based, more, you know, kind of more comfortable with subjectivity and so on. But, you know, like when you look at labor markets, I mean, there is always, there are always two narratives which kind of come with AI, that AI has a complementary effect, which you yourself, you know, were talking about earlier in the podcast, where, you know, you kind of get diagnostic tools, you get better information, you get quicker filtration criteria, and then it's a person who actually ends up taking a decision, albeit in a more efficient manner than he or she would have otherwise. And then there is always that, you know, that fear which comes, you know, that AI might have a replacement effect.
Sure.
You know, so within your experience, you know, within especially the life sciences and healthcare domain, like if I were to ask you in the next 5 to 10 years, are there some roles which you think are going to get redundant, and you know, net, are there going to be some new roles which are going to emerge because of the advent of AI? How do you see, you know, those two levers move with each other?
That's a good question, and sort of my first response to that is, you know, we don't know whether AI will replace, you know, a medical professional, you know, 10 years from now or something. But what is for sure is, you know, an AI plus a medical professional will replace a medical professional who's not using AI.
Right.
You know, so that, you know, in other words, you know, because these are I mean, it's like any other technology in a sense, right? And, populations that embrace newer techniques and technologies generally tend to replace populations that are not receptive to newer technologies. That's been the history of the world in a sense, you know. So that, and in the microcosm of healthcare professionals and that kind of thing, it's going to be the same thing. Now, having said that, do I see in absolute terms AI replacing a medical professional or a pharma scientist and that kind of thing? The answer is no. I don't think that's going to happen. Certainly not in let's say our lifetimes in that sense. You know. Now, would there be greater use of these technologies in terms of a physician arriving at a particular conclusion, given the data that is put in front of him and her and the AI system perhaps providing its own opinion and the physician then deciding to either accept or reject that opinion and those kind of things? Mm-hmm. That scenario I can see happening over the next decade. But an absolute, where it's a black box kind of thing where you just, as a patient, put in your sort of parameters in and then you get some response and that's it and you don't need to interact. That's probably not going to happen as much. Having said that, we all, to some extent, do that today. I mean, if you have a minor condition or something, we all go to the WebMD or something and then we sort of form our own little treatment in terms of herbs and medicines and whatever else. So at one level, we are kind of bypassing that, but certainly not on the serious questions and the serious conditions. I don't see that.
Mm-hmm. And, we see a lot of these big tech players, like be it Apple and Microsoft, they seem to talk a lot about investing heavily in healthcare and sort of, again, using an AI kind of a language, right, to sort of how they approach for the next 5-10 right. years. What role, do you think, I'm guessing you see that as a positive for the ecosystem, but how do you see that evolve? Like, that seems to be, even from general acquisitions of late, right, they're sort of moving more and more towards healthcare, and again, because they're use data, they're good at capturing data, right, and they sort of want to interpret it, right? How do you see that evolving? Right. That seems to be a clear focus, right?
Yeah, well, definitely. And given, some of the focus areas of your own organization, that's actually an important one to discuss. So certainly in the last 3 to 4 years, the Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Google, have all been extremely active in terms of acquiring companies or perhaps even funding internal programs in the healthcare space. One, because it's a massive market. Mm-hmm. And as you rightly said, they have several channels in which to capture data, right? And the holy grail in medicine, at least modern medicine today, is to offer personalized medicine.
Yeah.
Something that is tailored sort of to the last degree to you, in terms of your own parameters and your own sort of history and genetics and all of those kind of things, and then be able to offer something very extremely personalized. And these guys are already good at offering products that are quote-unquote personalized to you, albeit in a different space. They have certain learnings from there that they can translate by then capturing healthcare data and being able to do that. So there's no mystery on why they have moved in into this space, and that's great. That also means they're bringing in techniques and methods that perhaps this industry needs as well, because they are successful because they're good at what they do, and they can translate some of those across domains as well. So they're shown repeatedly, each one of them, and so that would work here as well. From an investment perspective, that obviously has made the space extremely hot in terms of the number of funding deals, etc., and that kind of thing. Any quarter I look at, the deal sort of venture-backed deals and those kind of things run into several $1 billion. I'm talking in the narrow sort of AI and life sciences space itself. I'm not even talking general AI and that kind of thing. So there's plenty there. I happen to think being in India is a huge advantage in that sense. And this sort of goes back to a couple of earlier questions also that we sort of discussed a little bit. Because data is a big need in AI. And if you're looking at needing large amounts of patient data, well, I mean, we have an inherent advantage in India, yeah. right, in terms of our patient diversity and the sheer volumes. And as you rightly said, end of the day, data is the game to have a world-class AI solution or yeah. a AI solution that's better than the rest. That's a direct function of the kind of data that you can provide. Mm-hmm. So that's speaks great to be a AI startup or a company in India, because you have an inherent data arbitrage advantage, mm-hmm. Compared to a company in Belgium or something like that, where obviously you're facing a very, very limited pool of patient data.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a significant advantage that comes in. Obviously, there are cost advantages, those kind of things, and the ability to draw upon skilled, human resources and those kind of things that will come in.
Yeah.
So, I'm bullish in terms of, the whole AI and life sciences space being in India. So there are certain secular advantages that we get being placed here.
No, that's fascinating. And, one of the things that we like to sort of do is look at businesses. So you are running a business. So we'll, a little bit of color on how sort of you think about revenue generation. Like, is it, just trying to go deeper into the markets, pick up more clients, and how is it typically structured? Is it like as a, subscription kind of a thing or product? Like, how do you think about your product portfolio and its evolution?
Sure.
And also basically, like, what are the biggest cost line items for a company like you? Is R&D big? Like, just to get a sense of how you think about your business.
If I step back on that for a second, the core thing that we do is analyzing pathology images, biopsy samples and tissue samples and that kind of thing, which, inherently used to be put on glass slides, and then people used to look through a microscope and do all those kind of things. Now, AI in the sort of healthcare space has been around for a while now, except it's been more on the radiology side of things, not pathology, which is where we operate in. It's been in the radiology side. Obviously, it's been on the hospital records and, patient records side of things also, in terms of data management. That's what extension of the data management side of things. That's been there as well. So, in India today, you have quite a few good people with really good products and world-class companies in AI, but in the radiology space.
Okay.
Now, radiology, think of AI in pathology, where we operate, as almost being 10, 15 years behind where AI in radiology was.
Right.
And the primary reason for that is radiology got digitized much earlier because it was easier to do those. Pathology now, with the rise of digital scanners in pathology and all, has just come to it now. So in some way, you have a roadmap in terms of what happened in AI and radiology, which is going to repeat 15 years later in the pathology space, from a sort of investment business side of thing, because that's the secular forces that are now coming in that have worked in another branch in here, and now they want to work here in pathology as well. So that's one part there. Now, the reason we don't have too many pathology AI companies, not just in India, but worldwide, is because it's a bit of a capex hurdle there. The digitization of pathology requires spectral digital scanners, which are a little bit capex intensive.
Okay.
So that automatically creates a barrier for two guys in a garage to be able to build a AI pathology startup, unless the two guys in the garage first go and get a significant amount of funding.
Okay.
So that's sort of the start in a sense. And so in that sense, we're reasonably well funded, and so we're in that sense have certain advantages there. Now, the other part so given that there is a certain capex investment into this, the question then is, what do we do in terms of the product and pricing strategy? Like, how do you get your ROI back on the investment you're making, right? So the other thing is, not only do you as a company need to make that capex investment, but the user of this product also needs to make certain capex investments, in terms of the GPU infrastructure and that kind of thing to run AI algorithms and that sort of thing. And that sometimes can be a deterrent. If you go past the top 20 sort of pharma companies globally, then suddenly these investments become a little bit more significant for a biotech or somebody like that to be able to do. And so there we have come up with standard SaaS based approaches to pricing in terms of being able to do on a usage kind of thing and those type of things. things, which has lowered the barriers significantly, you know, in terms of, so today we not only go to large hospitals or large pharmas, but we're able to go and dialogue with smaller firms as well, because they don't have to invest in the infrastructure. They can just use our products as a service, you know, delivered via an AWS or equivalent kind of thing, you know, and on a usage basis, so that they don't need to, you know, buy your license for a whole year and that kind of thing. So,
yeah.
So that's been a bit of a breakthrough in terms of how we're able to expand the market as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the things for the CapEx thing is, whatever the capex the user is supposed to fund, you guys can pay up, show massive free cash flow hits and profitability losses, and take it to a VC fund. They love that thing these days. Losses and no free cash flow, but user traction, that's it.
I was waiting for you to talk about that in terms of, you know, pre-funding revenues.
pre-funding. So Chad, this is super interesting. Obviously, you know, you have a very razor sharp B2B focus here. But you did mention ophthalmology in between, and you did mention like a app which kind of tracks things on 30 parameters. Sounded very much like a consumer play. Is that also on the cards at some point in time?
It's an interesting angle, huh?
Probably not for us. Yeah. You know, our expertise is more in working on.
Enterprise.
So far, B2B side of things. Because most of our products either go to a company or to a hospital, and then the user there is a trained professional. Could be a doctor, could be a microbiologist, could be a toxicology person. That's where we are. We did start off on this ophthalmology thing, in a sense of making it a quasi end consumer thing, but more from a social sort of perspective, because we're working with one of the larger ophthalmology institutes in the country, and the goal there is could we come up with some inexpensive solution that is still world-class, and we can go and put it in a village fair or in a kiosk somewhere and that kind of thing, where people can just go and do a self-serve in terms of, you know, just get your the photograph of your retina done, and then it gives you some basic guidelines in terms of, okay, you know, red means see your, do make an appointment with the doctor right away, yellow, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
At least to be, in the Indian context, you know, something that becomes a sort of first flag type of thing. And, that's kind of where, from our perspective, the customer there is still sort of the hospital that's going to put up the kiosks, in a sense. And so, you know, even though the end user there might, in that sense, be the classic sort of consumer play. We're not looking at it in that sense. We still think of it ourselves as a little bit more of an enterprise or B2B type of thing.
Right. And, from a geography perspective, obviously, like you are much more focused on US, North America. At the moment, the idea is to go deeper and deeper into those markets. Data arbitrage ops.
Right now, our customers are, unfortunately don't have any customers in India, but hopefully the beginnings of investment in digital infrastructure to a meaningful level now happening, that probably change. But our customers are North America, Europe, Japan, Israel, if you look at the sort of clinical side of things, by and large, our operations are in North America and the UK. But if you look at the pharmaceutical side of things, then most pharma majors are multinational themselves. So
right.
We happen to be working with a significant number of the top 10 global pharmas. So and they are both in Europe and US simultaneously, by and large, right? Almost all of them, by definition, have significant operations in both areas. So that's kind of our footprint as well.
Right. Thank you so much, Chad. This has been a delightful conversation. For a change, we didn't talk much about COVID.
Yeah, I was about to say this was because in the last few podcasts we've had, like, COVID takes such a central theme. We've talked about business, and it's been a nice chat. No, thank you for your time. It was a fascinating chat.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you guys.
No, likewise. And I think a couple of such chats, and Sharad, we can be pseudo experts in another realm. What do you say about that? No, Chad, this was great fun. I hope you also enjoyed this and wish you all the best with the Aerometrics. We'll definitely be watching it closely and maybe bring you in for another chat in a few months as per your convenience. Wish you all the best, and please be safe. And with that, Sharad, I think this is it for this week. What do you say?
Yeah.
And
Stay safe.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. We'll be back soon with a new exciting guest. So this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Duplan.
Signing off. Yeah.